You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
On this week's tour around the NL Central, the Brewers find a new home for Jonathan Lucroy, but not without some difficulty. The Cubs with an incredible win on Sunday Night Baseball, and yet another injured infielder for the St. Louis Cardinals. We kick things off this week with our Cubs reporter, Kerry Muscat. You know, Kerry, it's not supposed to be this easy where a team, you know, pushes their bullpen to their limits in winning an extra innings one night, meaning Sunday night, that epic comeback against the M's, which we'll get to in a minute. But then because of that, the next day you need your starter to give you some length and give you some distance, and that's exactly what the Cubs did, and more particularly Kyle Hendricks, as he gives the team his second career shutout. He goes all nine, you know, and at this moment, you know, yes, you've got your Lesters and your Arrietas and other guys in that rotation performing well, but at this moment, as of this conversation, is Kyle Hendricks the best pitcher in that rotation?
As of right now today, yeah. I mean, he's been – it was interesting. Joe Maddon said it was similar to – it was just a different version of what Jake Arrieta did in the second half last year when Arrieta went on his roll and was like 12-1 after the break. Kyle's been nothing short of phenomenal to watch. And, of course, what I like is that he's not blowing people away with 99 miles an hour. He's just outsmarting them. He's pitching. And he's pitching really well, and he's been able to locate his pitches, and he's been able to just keep hitters off balance, and it's been fun to watch. He was dropping his curveball against the Marlins on Monday night and normally doesn't use that as much and as effectively, and it was really fun to see. So I think he got Giancarlo Stanton on that one time.
He's been tremendous, and as we've outlined in previous podcasts, he's been good all year, but he's been superhuman at home. And can you tell that, you know, in particular, when he does make those home starts, is he aware of how dominant he's been at Wrigley Field? And does he take the mound with more of an aura and more of a confidence about him during those home starts? Can you notice something of a difference there?
I'm not sure I'd ever use the word aura around Kyle. anybody who's been around him knows that he's a very low-key guy. If he was walking down the street around Wrigley Field, no one would really know that he was a ball player. He just looks like some other, you know, preppy kid. Aura is not the word. I think he's just confident here, and he's comfortable. And if you're comfortable and you're confident and you know what you can do, it seems to translate well. He's well aware of the difference between home and road. In the start before this, he was pitching at the White Sox ballpark, and he was still in Chicago, and we were joking that it should feel like home, and it didn't quite translate. So he knows that he's got to get that, even that up a little bit. Somehow he's a Dartmouth grad. I think that he'll figure it out.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not too worried about him. And I think the numbers were, after last night's start on Monday, the complete game shutouts, 1.17 ERA at home. It blows your mind, and you made the great comparison about how it's been Arrieta-esque from what he did in the second half of last year to the first, you know, 7-8 starts of this year. Kyle Hendricks has been that good for this Cubs team. Kerry, a bit off track here, but considering it's a major storyline in baseball right now, Ichiro, of course, one of my favorite moments from last night's game. Pinch hitting in the seventh, got some good wood on it, but lined out to Chris Bryant. But before that, rousing standing ovation from the crowd at Wrigley. It was as if he had spent 20 seasons in a Cubs uniform, and he was, you know, a Cubs legend. But I mean, the Cubs fans are just that great, giving Ichiro that kind of applause and that kind of recognition. How much are you hoping, somewhat selfishly maybe, that Ichiro gets these next two hits at Wrigley Field?
Well, it'd be kind of fun to see. He's going there's some, but I haven't seen the lineup for Tuesday's game. There's a little bit of buzz that he might start Wednesday because he has more at bats against John Lackey than any other pitcher. So there's a chance that he could face Lackey on Wednesday. It'd be fun to see. The only player that ever got his 3,000th hit at Wrigley was Stan Musial back in 1958. And the funny thing about that is the Cardinals, he wasn't in the starting lineup. He got a pinch hit double. The Cardinals didn't want him to play because they were hoping he'd get that 3,000th hit at home. So I was about to call them the Mariners because I'm so used to Ichiro there. The Marlins go from Chicago to Colorado, and I think if given the choice, I think Ichiro would rather do it in Chicago than Colorado. I don't know that for a fact, but if it were me, that's where I would rather do it.
So. Yeah, I mean, no offense to Colorado, you know, the, right, or the Rockies,
but not,
or anything.
I like Denver. Denver's sure. Great city.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. But, yeah, given a choice, I think he would rather do it in some place as historic as Wrigley Field against a franchise like the Chicago Cubs. And we'll see if he is in the starting lineup on Wednesday, taking on a guy in Lackey that he's faced a ton of times. What a moment that would be. Still 2 hits shy of that magical 3,000-hit mark. And, Carey, back to the Cubs now. Just when we thought the Cubs were done making bullpen deals, they make another one on Monday by trading for Angels reliever Joel Smith. His numbers in previous years, outstanding. Not quite the case this year, but I think his primary appeal, if you talk to Joe Maddon, and you have, obviously, is that his appeal, again, not the numbers so much, but in the fact that he brings something of a different look to that bullpen, if you can kind of elaborate on that.
Yeah, I think what Joe Maddon told us is that he likes funk and that Joe Smith has some funk to him. He's a sidearm pitcher. Maddon compared this to 2008 when the Rays added Chad Bradford, another sidearm pitcher. Smith just really gives the Cubs a different look coming out of the bullpen. You know, they've got pitchers down there who are somewhat similar. This is just something different. He's hoping this will be somebody to use against tough right-handed hitters. If he needs a ground ball, this will be the guy to go to. It should be a good fit. The nice thing is the Cubs have some depth in the system where they still have Justin Grimm and they have Trevor Cahill down there. So they still have some other parts that they can consider, you know, as the season progresses.
Adam, thanks so much for the time on this Tuesday. And the Brewers were expected to be a busy team leading up to the trade deadline. They did not disappoint, as David Stern certainly made the most of those few days leading up to the August 1st deadline, getting a very impressive haul of prospects back in return for some of the coveted veterans on this roster. But I want to start off with the entire ordeal about Jonathan Lucroy. As everybody knows by now, he was at one time a future Cleveland Indian. That did not happen. And I think a kind of knee-jerk reaction from fans when they saw that whole thing unfold was, well, you know, why doesn't a guy like Jonathan Lucroy, playing for a team going nowhere this year, not want to join a first-place team with a legitimate shot at the World Series? But when you really break things down, a lot of contractual and financial reasons why he put the squash on this trade, if you can kind of elaborate on those and explain why he said no to this deal.
Yeah, I'm going to try to not use up our entire podcast on this. But here's what it comes down to, Matt. If this were a revenue-neutral situation for Jonathan Lucroy, he's a Cleveland Indian right now, in my opinion. He picked them on his no trade when they were not expected to be as good as they are. He had no problem with Cleveland in itself. I think he likes that team, where they're going, all of that. But he is a player playing on one of, if not baseball's most friendliest, club-friendliest contracts. For years, he has had zero financial leverage. This was a moment, his first in years, of financial leverage, and it is not uncommon at all for a player to, in exchange for waiving a no trade, to get something in return. The Indians, and I've confirmed this because this is how it was first reported and it's correct, they not only were unwilling to offer a financial sweetener or waive the club option for next season, which was obvious. They're not going to give up as much as they were for just 2 months of Lucroy. Beyond those two things, they could not tell him that he was going to be the catcher next season in a contract year. Remember, they have Yan Gomes. He's hurt, having a bad year, but also hurt into September. But he's a player who's under contract for long term, younger, part of their future. So Jonathan Lucroy faced a situation where not only was he not going to get a little something extra for waiving this no trade and using this little bit of leverage that he has, but he was potentially going to put himself in a damaging situation by going into a contract year and becoming Joe Mauer, where you play catcher, or you play first base, and you DH. Now, for Joe Mauer, that's fine. He's got the big contract. For Lucroy, this is his one shot to take care of his family for the rest of everybody's life. So that's kind of how this came to be. I'm not sure, you know, you want to blame someone when something like this happens. I'm not sure there is anyone to blame. You can't present this to Lucroy and get him in touch with the Indians until you have a deal in place. So I don't really blame the Brewers. I don't blame the Indians. and from their point of view, they're giving up four really good prospects already. Why should they have to pay anything extra on top of that? It just didn't work out. The Brewers had to go back to the drawing board. And, of course, we know in the end they did find a deal. The Indians aren't happy, but I think Jonathan Lucroy is happy where he did end up going, which is Texas.
Yeah, I think that's a good point about how when things like this happen, you know, everybody's first reaction is to assign blame and to point fingers and say, you know, you screwed up or you did something wrong. And sometimes that's just not the case. You know, the Indians have their rights. The Brewers have their rights. And Jonathan Lucroy certainly has his rights. He knows that at age 30, you know, he's got one last, big payday. He knows where his career is at. He knows what his age is, obviously. So does everybody else. So, again, there's no real bad guys here in this. It's just something that simply did not work out. End of discussion. Now, the one thing that I need you to make clear to me and maybe some other people is that I'm having a hard time believing that this entire process got to a veto point. And by that, what I mean is, were there any sort of preliminary discussions between David Stearns and Jonathan Lucroy to tell him, you know, hey, look, here's what's going on. You know, it's no secret. You're on the trade block, and here are the teams we're talking to. I know that, you know, this particular team, meaning the Indians, is on your no-trade list, but still we're having discussions with them. Was there any sort of communication between the two sides? And what I'm getting at here is, you know, how did it get to the point where a player literally had to say, no, I don't accept this trade?
Well, I don't 100% know the answer to this. I think the way, as you suggested, it's logical that even if it's technically not allowed, this some sort of discussion like that would have happened. But until you put the player with the other team and they start talking about those factors I just ran through, you don't know how it's going to turn out. You can't put Jonathan Lucroy and his representative in touch with the Indians to see how they're going to work it out if they get to the point of making a trade when you don't have a trade. So I think you had to come to an agreement on the players first. You have to do things in a certain order, in other words. So, again, I've kind of thought through this. I'm not sure how this could have been avoided. I'm very interested at some moment to sit down with David Stearns where the cameras aren't rolling and the recorders aren't rolling and kind of have a conversation about can this be avoided in the future. But, again, it's sometimes things happen and it's business and it's a little messy, but it doesn't mean anybody was wrong. And I sort of think this might be one of those positions where at least you can see everybody's point of view here.
Yeah, I agree where, you know, you see it from all three sides, as we talked about, the Indian side, the Brewers side, and Jonathan Lucroy's side. And like you said, it would be interesting, you know, where there's no cameras or tape recorders rolling, to really get David Stern's thoughts on what really went down, what really didn't go down, how this whole thing came about. A timeline, but again, until or unless that happens, it's very hard to kind of put those pieces together and figure out, you know, how it got to this veto point. It's rare that this happens, but it does happen, and it happens certainly with Jonathan Lucroy. Now, Adam, as you touched on, it seems like the Indians were ready to throw a king's ransom at Milwaukee's direction to get Lucroy. Part of the reason why they didn't want to further incentivize his contract financially, because like you said, they were giving up the moon and stars from a prospect perspective to get this guy. So now that thing falls through. Days later, as we saw, the Brewers then deal him and their closer Jeremy Jeffress to Texas, but for a package that maybe you could argue not as impressive as what Cleveland was offering for Lucroy by himself. Is that your assessment of this, or maybe not quite?
Well, look, I always have a hard time judging this kind of stuff because I'm reading the same lists and scouting reports you are and everyone else is. I have not put my eyeballs on these players. So I think everybody is kind of guessing when they make these snap judgments right at the deadline. I will say that my first reaction as an uneducated observer was, wow, it seems like they would have got more. And that's not because of Jonathan Lucroy. To me, it's because of Jeremy Jeffress. And you look at what Will Smith fetched from the Giants, a top 100 prospect and their best pitching prospect, plus a young catcher. You look what Andrew Miller got for the Yankees from the Indians, a huge haul, way more, it seems to me, than Jonathan Lucroy was going to cost them. The price of relief was extremely high, and when you look at packaging Lucroy and Jeffress and you get two good prospects, it seemed a little light. Now, it depends on what you're looking for as a team. The Brewers have been kind of a volume team in a lot of their deals. In other words, they have gotten maybe not, you know, an Addison Russell-type prospect when he moved to the Cubs. They haven't gotten that top guy. They've gotten a lot of good prospects, and they're sort of, it looks like they're trying to gather volume and see who emerges. But in the case of this Rangers trade, they got two prospects who, for whatever the rankings are worth, were more highly ranked than the best prospect they were going to get in the Indians trade. So maybe they didn't get as much volume in this case, but perhaps they got more quality. And that would make sense because they included a really good reliever in Jeremy Jeffress. Now, the one thing I think everybody, the reason this grading the trade deadline is difficult to do 20 minutes after the deadline passes is in this case, there's a player to be named later. We don't know anything so far about the nature of those players. I'm going to guess that it's a pretty good player, and I'm going to guess that when that player emerges, it's going to change the outlook of this trade a little bit. Now, some people still might look at, even if it's three good prospects, and say the Brewers didn't get enough for two really good players. And that certainly is a valid argument, especially in light of that veto. And you got to figure David Stearns was not in the strongest of bargaining positions after the Brewers had a trade. It falls apart. The whole baseball world knows they want to trade this guy. Now they have to go out and find a good offer. So it did seem a little bit light. All I'm saying is let's wait and see who that third player is.
Trade deadline, of course, Adam, and the Pirates, among a handful of teams, are very active. But the Pirates active in to a different degree than most other teams, I feel, because, you know, when it comes to the trade deadline, the saying is that you want to be a buyer or a seller, but never both. But I think that's kind of what the Pirates were when you look at the overall scope of what Neil Huntington did. But in my opinion, given the Pirates' status as a contending team, but one with limited financial resources, that's, of course, not a secret or breaking news by any means. But was this the right strategy to both buy and sell to make moves with an eye towards both the present and the future?
You know, it's hard to say for now if it was the right strategy, just because, you know, you don't know how some of these deals are going to pan out in the long term. But when you look at where they are in the standings after that pretty bad sweep against the Brewers in Miller Park over the weekend, you know, they were one game over 500. They were essentially out of the NL Central race. I think it's pretty fair to say that at this point, if it wasn't fair to say so a little while ago. And the wild card, you know, they're still behind a couple of teams. They're 3.5-4 games out. I don't think, you know, the difference in what they gave away versus what they got back is what's going to keep them out of the wild card race. You know, if they're going to make that, it's going to be because guys like Andrew McCutchen, Josh Harrison, Jung Ho Kang, John Jaso, the list goes on, bounce back, you know, and the rotation gives them what they need. You know, it's not going to be because, you know, Francisco Liriano was going to get it done, or, you know, the drop-off between Mark Melanson and Felipe Rivero was really going to be the big difference down the stretch. So I think, you know, it's been perceived a little bit, you know, in Pittsburgh and maybe nationally as the Pirates kind of giving up on the season. I don't think that's the case. I think they do still want to win, but I think they may have retrenched a little bit in some of the things they did, specifically the kind of controversial Francisco Liriano trade. You know, the Mark Melanson deal, people can kind of understand from a baseball perspective. It's something this team has done before. The Liriano trade is just so unusual looking that I think it throws some people off guard. But, you know, they're still contending for a wild card spot. They still have the talent in place, you know, to go after and get it. And they have added at least a couple of pieces, you know, upgraded minorly in a couple of areas where they feel like they can, you know, be in a better position to do that.
Yeah, well said. It's definitely, it's not a black and white, cut and dry situation with the Pirates, you know, given where they are in the standings. And you brought up that very highly disappointing sweep at the hands of a Milwaukee of all teams who just, you know, sold off a bunch of parts themselves. So the Pirates now, as of this discussion, one game over 500. And I think, you know, the average baseball fan, they see, you know, Pirates trade Mark Melanson, they trade Francisco Liriano. Those are two big names. And it's easy to perceive that, you know what, they're giving up. They're waving the white flag. Not quite the case, you know, like you just detailed. That's definitely a balancing act right now. But, Adam, I want to break down that Melanson trade a little bit further. I think, you know, even though the Liriano one perhaps caught more people off guard, this one was still something of a surprise, I think, to some degree. First of all, how do you grade the return that the Pirates got back from the Nationals in that deal? And the second part is, I know the Pirates have faith that Tony Watson can slide seamlessly into that ninth inning role. I don't doubt that, but is he the long-term answer in that position or just the answer for now?
No, I think Tony Watson is the answer for this season and next season. He's a guy who we've seen as a closer in waiting for quite some time. He has the stuff. He has the durability. He definitely has the temperament, I think, to handle that role. There wasn't a whole lot of question in the Pirates clubhouse about, you know, his ability to do that. There was some, you know, doubt, I guess you would say, disappointment maybe, that a team that says it's contending for a wild card spot or a playoff spot would trade its closer, its all-star closer. But, you know, this is a trade the Pirates have essentially made before. It's kind of how they got Mark Melancon in the first place when they traded Joel Hanrahan to Boston. And one of the guys they got back was a young, controllable reliever by the name of Mark Melancon. And this time they traded Melancon, you know, a pending free agent at the end of the season for the big return was a young, controllable reliever, left-hander who throws real hard, has really good stuff by the name of Felipe Rivero from the Nationals. So he was the big haul. He's going to be under club control for five seasons after this one. Some scouts have said that he has closer stuff, so perhaps he could be the long-term answer in the closer role. And then in that trade, they also got a young left-handed starter named Taylor Hearn. He's, you know, maybe a bottom low 20s prospect in the Pirates system, but, you know, good stuff, projectable, you know, somebody you could see down the line in the rotation many years to come or potentially another trade chip if they want to head in that direction. But I think the Melancon trade, like I said, people kind of understood because we've seen this form of trade before, not only recently in baseball, but specifically with the Pirates, and it's what brought the Melancon. So that one was a little bit of an easier sell, both I think in the clubhouse and to the fan base.
And that's a great reminder of just how the Pirates did acquire Mark Melancon at one point in time, because I had completely forgotten that he was not only with the Red Sox at one point, but he was kind of a disaster with them. He just did not take to that environment, to the AL East, and people thought, you know, this guy has no value. But lo and behold, he, you know, goes to the National League, a new team, new pitching coach, new environment, voila. Turns into one of baseball's our premier relievers, so hopefully the Lightning can strike twice again with the Pirates, this time trading Melancon to the Washington Nationals. And, of course, I want to get your thoughts on Liriano, too, because, like you said, that was the bigger surprise of the two. It's been interesting the last few weeks with Liriano because three starts ago, I believe in late July, had that outstanding start against Milwaukee, 13 strikeouts and no walks, I think was the more impressive part because he leads baseball and walks allowed. But then he reverted back to his struggling self in these two most recent starts, one of those against Milwaukee in what turned out to be his last start in a Pirates uniform. But my question for you is, you know, was Neil Huntington kind of shopping him all along, even when he turned in that outstanding 13K no-walk performance? Or was the thought process, you know what, he's turned the corner, I want to hang on to this guy, but then things kind of went south with these last two starts, and then the decision was made to kind of ship him out of town. Which of it was more?
I think they've been looking for a little while now for a place to land Liriano, just because of the way he struggled early on. You know, for so much of the season now, it's been, what, just about 4 months that he hasn't been the guy that he was in 2013 to 2015. And, you know, Huntington said on the conference call after you know, the trade was made, that they had some really good internal debate about whether they thought, you know, Liriano was going to be that guy or the guy that he's been this season. And ultimately, you can tell based on the fact that they were so eager to trade him that they included two top 10 prospects in the deal, they thought he was going to be this guy. You know, the league may have figured some things out with him, you know, that he was just not in a place where they could get him back to who he was in the previous couple of years. So, you know, it would have made sense all along, I think, to shop Liriano just because, you know, it's a little bit of a big contract by the Pirates, you know, pretty meager standards of what they're able to do with their payroll. You know, he's got another year and 2 months left on that deal. You could see somebody even potentially buying low on Liriano just because of the potential that he had. That didn't actually turn out to be the case. I think the rest of the league might agree with the Pirates' assessment of the way Liriano was trending because my understanding of the situation is they could only find one team that was willing to take on his entire contract, and that was the Toronto Blue Jays, who, you know, in giving up Drew Hutchison, the right-hander the Pirates got back in return, you know, Pittsburgh also had to include these two pretty good prospects. We can talk about that a little bit more, but, you know, two name top 10 in their system prospects, essentially, you know, you could look at it as one for Hutchison and another one for the Blue Jays being willing to take on Liriano's entire contract. So it's a really complicated trade. It's not one that has gone over particularly well in Pittsburgh so far, but ultimately, when you look at how does it affect the Pirates' chances in 2016, they traded away arguably the worst starter in baseball this year. How does replacing him with Ivan Nova, you know, does that make the rotation worse? I don't know. It's hard to say what you would have gotten from Liriano down the stretch or what you will get from Nova. So I'm gonna hold back on judging that trade too bad until we see how Nova does, how Liriano does, and how the two prospects ultimately pan out down the stretch.
As always, and let's kind of start off with a rather odd Cardinals statistic of the day. This may blow your mind. It may not. I don't know. But after last night's loss to the Reds, the Cardinals, the only team in the National League to lose two games where they hit four home runs. And I don't know what this proves other than the fact that I spend way too much time on Baseball Reference, something I looked up. So there you go. So it does prove, I guess, too, that the Cardinals are crushing the ball as they've done all season. The pitching has not been there at times. It was not there last night for Son Heung-oh. He had not given up a run in 25 innings on the road this season, a very impressive streak that comes to an end with an exclamation point as Scott Schebler hits the walk-off shot in the ninth. But, you know, considering how hot the Cubs are right now, they won again today in walk-off fashion at home against the Marlins. Last night's loss, a really tough one to swallow for this team.
Yeah, it is. And really, you know, this road trip got off to such a good start with a series win in New York, two wins to start that series in Miami. And this team, actually on Saturday, after watching the Cubs lose, a win that night would have pulled the Cardinals within 5.5 games of the Cubs, a deficit as small as they haven't had since April. All of a sudden now here we're looking at a double-digit deficit looming. The Cardinals have lost three in a row, two of the last two on walk-off hits. So, yeah, definitely a disappointing little stretch here to toward the end of this road trip. This is also a kind of a critical stretch for the Cardinals in that between the Reds and then the Braves and Reds coming to town for the next home game. This is an opportunity to play some really good ball against teams that are having a very poor year. And these are the types of games that the Cardinals need to win. First off, is again, if they want to stay at all in that NL Central race, but certainly with where they're positioned in the NL wildcard race to keep pace there and perhaps make a move up those standings.
Yeah, just you know, the tempo of last night's game on Tuesday was that, you know, you look at the game, they come into the eighth, I think, trailing, and then they get a home run from Brandon Moss, his first game back off the DL. Now we're tied. Then Tommy Pham comes up, a pinch hitter. He homers. So now you bring a lead into the to the ninth inning. Son Heung-oh had not given up a run on the road all season, and boom, there goes the lead. There goes the game. A very tough loss for the Cardinals last night on Tuesday. And, Jen, that was just the culmination of a very tough day preceding the game because the Cardinals learned that's yet another injury, this time to Aledmys Diaz. He was placed on the 15-day DL due to a hairline fracture in his thumb. And an injury very similar in nature to what sidelined Johnny Peralta, the man that Diaz replaced at shortstop at the onset of the season. So the wheel goes round and round. And again, it's another version of musical chairs, if you will, on this Cardinals infield. So kind of take us through one more time the domino effect that this is going to have. Diaz gone. Peralta is back and healthy, at least for now. Let's see if that maintains. But how do things shake out now that Aledmys Diaz is the one that finds himself on the DL?
Yeah, I mean, this is very disappointing in many facets for the Cardinals. I mean, first off, the fact that they felt like they were getting so healthy this week with Peralta and Moss, as you mentioned, coming back, Matt Carpenter on the cusp of coming back on Friday. So the Cardinals thought that for the first time, maybe basically all year, that they'd have their full offense together. All of a sudden, Diaz gets hit by a pitch on Sunday. Monday's x-rays showed that was a little more significant an injury than initially expected. So what it means right now is that Peralta will be playing shortstop again, so which is an easy kind of fix for the Cardinals, and they have the obvious fit defensively. I think the question offensively is how the Cardinals fill Diaz's spot in the two-hole. I mean, it's been no secret that he has been one of the best rookies in baseball this year, a guy who was probably neck and neck with Corey Seager for Rookie of the Year honors. This is certainly going to hurt that. But for the Cardinals right now, not to have Matt Carpenter, their prolific leadoff hitter, and not to have Aledmys Diaz in that two spot, they really don't have a good answer yet as to who will fill in that gap. So whether it becomes Brandon Moss, whether it's even Scotty, Jed Jerko has had a very good month of July. We'll see. But that's going to be the biggest challenge for this club, is seeing where they can get that offensive production as they wait for Diaz to come back. They do hope, you know, unlike Peralta's issue with his thumb that requires surgery, that Diaz can heal without needing any procedure, and that he will be back at some point this year. The question that we don't have an answer to right now, though, is how long his absence will be.
And that leads me kind of to my next point, is that John Mozeliak, you know, kind of told the media a couple days ago that, you know, yes, he's on the 15-day DL, And, you know, most fans look at that and say, well, he'll be back in 2 weeks, maybe two and a half. But Mosaic seemed to indicate that this is not going to be a 15-day stint. And even though there's no timetable on it, it appears that this injury is a bit more significant, a bit more severe than it appeared at first. You agree?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think this could easily be something that keeps him out for the month of August. I mean, we are kind of looking at a big window in that the Cardinals expect it to be more than 15 days, which is mid-August, but they do not expect to cost him the season, which is obviously late September, early October. So, you know, within that time frame, I would imagine it's going to be probably 3-4 weeks before he can really start ramping up baseball activities again. And then, of course, it's how he responds from there. So, you know, the Cardinals are hopeful. Again, the fact that they have Johnny Peralta, a very proven shortstop, able to fill in immediately in that spot is good news. But they're going to miss Aledmys Díaz and certainly that production that he was providing and what's been a very special season for him.
Yeah, I think most people would agree that the NL Rookie of the Year race is going to come down between himself and Trevor Story. Story himself now is injured, so that's just weird the way that timed out between the two guys that many consider the front runners for that NL Rookie of the Year award. We'll see what happens, and hopefully a speedy return for Aledmys Díaz. And sending Díaz to the DL, Jen, just one of a series of roster moves for this team in recent days. We talked about Peralta, talked about Brandon Moss. At the other end of that spectrum, Randal Grichuk has been optioned to AAA yet again. I read a staggering figure on Grichuk that you had. 42 at-bats since the All-Star break, 22 strikeouts. That's hard to wrap your head around. Now, when he was optioned the first time, I think the line of thinking was, you know what, talented kid, he's slumping, he's going to go down to AAA, get his act together, and return to the majors and be the player that he was, the player that he was when he first got called up and the player that we know he can be. But I got to think that now it's a totally different line of thinking the second time around, and I would tend to think not quite as much optimism regarding Randal Grichuk.
Yeah, I mean, the Cardinals aren't ready to give up on him in total. I mean, this is a guy who's 24 years old, you know, still a very young player. But certainly there is a level of disappointment in that he hasn't been able to provide the sort of production the Cardinals were anticipating. I mean, let's not forget that they opened the season with Randal Grichuk as their everyday center fielder. His presence in that spot was one of the reasons why the Cardinals didn't pivot after Jason Hayward went elsewhere to find another outfielder. I mean, they had big expectations for both he and Steven Piscotty, and to this point, only Piscotty has lived up to those. So, you know, Grichuk all of a sudden started struggling here, as you mentioned, the rising strikeout total being the biggest kind of red flag there. And at some point, he was going to stop getting playing time here. Cardinals feel, because he's still a young player, still trying to figure out his swing and still trying to get himself right mentally, the best place for him to do that is in AAA Memphis, where he doesn't necessarily have the pressure of having to produce every day, where he can work on his swing and where he can show up to the ballpark every day and know that he's going to get 3 or 4 at-bats. That was just no longer going to be the case here. So, you know, the residual effect of that, of course, in St. Louis is that the Cardinals now, you know, don't really have an obvious center field fit. We saw Steven Piscotty play it here the first game in Cincinnati. He's not a natural center fielder, can cover it fine, but weakens your defense when you have to move him there. Tommy Pham, Jeremy Hazelbaker, maybe even Colton Wong will get some opportunities. But Grichuk was a guy that the Cardinals saw would be a staple to the middle of their order. And to this point, he's just not been able to put it together this year. And the hope is that there's still time for that to come. I just don't know if that's going to be this year or maybe in the future.
And, Jen, you mentioned Colton Wong, you know, for a while. You know, he, too, was struggling. He got sent down to AAA, gets called back up. He saw some time in center field upon being called back up. Then got shifted to second base when Carpenter got hurt, some other guys got hurt, and he's kind of been on that yo-yo between center field and second base. So now with Grichuk in AAA for the foreseeable future, can we expect to see a lot more of Colton Wong in center field? If not being the everyday guy, a most everyday guy, I guess.
I think we'll see him there fairly substantially, especially once Matt Carpenter comes back at the end of this week. Because once you get Matt Carpenter back, you know, all of a sudden you have Carp either filling that second base or third base hole. And with the way Jed Jerko has produced lately, Jed Jerko, mind you, has very quietly snuck up and hit 15 home runs this year as a part-time player, had a terrific month of July. So the Cardinals would like to keep his bat in there. So if you want to keep Jerko in there, if you have Carpenter back in the infield, Peralta obviously at short, you know, they might squeeze Colton Wong out of an opportunity at second base, but I do think we are going to see him to some extent in the outfield. So he continues to get his work there pregame to track fly balls, to try to get a little bit more comfortable. Good news for Colton, too, is that he looks more comfortable at the plate, and ultimately that's going to dictate his playing time. If he can produce offensively, this team has shown that they'll find a fit for you defensively. And you know, Colton seems to have found kind of his base at the plate, seems to be in a good place mentally. talked to me this weekend about feeling like for the first time in his career, he really understands his swing. And when something doesn't go right, he can identify right away what the issue was and correct it. And that's something that in the past has taken him much longer to do. So, yeah, we're going to see Cole Longman-Brown. That's really kind of the MO of this team, is everybody plays everywhere on any given day. It's a bunch of mixing and matching to this point with so-so results, but it certainly helped the Cardinals through some of these other injuries.
Phil, we certainly appreciate the time. A lot to get to today. We're just hours removed from the Reds' 7-0 victory over the Cardinals in today's rubber game at Great American Ballpark. We're going to talk about that and about the performance in particular of Brandon Finnegan just in a couple of minutes. But first and foremost, the big newsmaker this week, without question, the trade of Jay Bruce. He ends up going to the New York Mets, and the Reds getting a pretty nice package back in return. So kind of a two-part question here, Phil. Bruce had that red-hot streak heading into the trade deadline, a very well-timed hot streak, if you will, homered in 5 straight games to tie a franchise record. So how much did that streak enhance his trade value? And then how much do you like the package in return that the Reds got back from the New York Mets?
Well, Matt, the issue, or the always going to be the distinction from this trade, is that Jay Bruce became the first player ever traded while leading his league in RBI. When you look at it that way, you know, I think you could understand people not thinking that the Reds got enough in this deal, but the way it shook out, it looked like Brandon Nimmo, the Mets prospect, was going to be the biggest piece going back, but it wound up being a second baseman, Dilson Herrera. I like Herrera a lot. I saw him early last year, when Daniel Murphy was on the disabled list. He came up from Double-A, and he's a very competitive hitter, a top of the order type guy. And whenever the Reds are ready to phase out Brandon Phillips, they will have a replacement part. They also get a left-handed pitcher who was one of the top 100 picks in the 2015 draft. So he's got the kind of an arm that teams look for. So I think they did wind up turning Jay Bruce into useful parts. It sure took a long time to do it, but, you know, I think if Herrera pans out for a rental on 2 months of Jay Bruce, it'll be a nice return.
Yeah, certainly, and that's a great stat that I didn't even realize about Jay Bruce, the first player ever dealt when at the time of the deal leading the league in RBIs. That's quite the eye-opener, so maybe a win-win here as the Reds getting back a nice package, and if Bruce can have anything resembling the impact that Yoenis Cespedes had for the Mets last year, then they will certainly be happy in and around Citi Field, no question. Phil, one guy that did not get dealt, to his surprise a little bit and to most people's surprise, I would think, Zach Cozart, who's currently banged up a little bit, but Cozart quoted as saying that he was surprised that the trade deadline came and went. He still found himself in a Reds uniform. Were you surprised that Cozart was not dealt?
Yeah, a little bit surprised. There were a lot of players around baseball that were on the blocks and weren't traded. In Chicago, you know, the White Sox had half a dozen, including Todd Frazier, the former Red. Only 1 year left. The White Sox talking about rebuilding, you would have thought he would have been a guy that would have been moved. Cozart's a little bit different because, the Reds are going to have him under control for a while yet. A very productive offensive player. Seattle seemed like a match. They had lost Ketel Marte to injury. They're hanging around the edges of the American League wild card race, what looks like a very good race. I thought Cozart was a fit, and the team seemed to be engaged in serious talks for a long amount of time before the deadline. Normally, there can a situation like that will lead to a deal, but it did not in this one. And, you know, it won't be the Reds' last chance to trade Zach Cozart, who, to his credit, has had a very good year this year. He's came up, he was considered a glove man, and he sort of emerged as a hitter. Needs to stay healthy for a full season, and you know, as timing would have it, after that trade, he's been sidelined with a bruised finger. So, you know, I think Cozart's health's an issue. But I, like everybody else, I did think he was headed to the Mariners.
Yeah, I think a lot of people did. A lot of people had him penciled for somewhere out of town, no doubt. But here it is, the first week in August. He is still a Cincinnati Red. And, Phil, on the topic of trades and guys that were brought back in big trades, you go back to 1 year ago, the Reds dealing Johnny Cueto to the Kansas City Royals. In return, they get a guy back by the name of Brandon Finnegan. And, boy, did he look good today as the Reds defeat the Cardinals 7-0 to win the rubber game of that series. And Finnegan again, six scoreless, gave up one hit, and he's now put together 12 scoreless innings in his last two starts combined. You know, as far as Finnegan goes, Phil, the talent's always been there. That's been unquestioned. But do you think he's finally starting to turn the corner in terms of consistency, which has kind of eluded him thus far in his big league career?
Well, maybe, but in his defense, what a career he's had. I mean, he was drafted in 2014, wound up pitching in the World Series that year, pitched in the College World Series and the Major League World Series the same year. So he was rushed through the minor leagues. And then with the Royals, they didn't seem to really ever give him a real shot in the rotation. They always had guys like Danny Duffy ahead of him. They brought him up as a bullpen piece. The White Sox did that with Chris Sale, but then they moved him right into the rotation and left him. The Royals, instead of doing that with Finnegan, they used him in a trade, helped them get to their second World Series. I think just repetitions and innings. And, you know, right off the bat this year, Finnegan took a no-hitter into the sixth inning at Wrigley Field and showed right from the start that, you know, when he's throwing his breaking pitch, his slider over the plate with his fastball, he has a world of potential. And, yeah, I think he has built off it. It's been maybe a little bit of a roller coaster up and down year, but that's what you expect with young pitching. And it's not like he came to the Reds as a guy that had been had gone stale elsewhere in a system. He was just used in some short-term ways at a point in his career where normally the thinking is long-term.
Yeah, no question. And you brought up that start against the Cubs at Wrigley Field all the way back in April, and I think it's worth noting that his two outings this year where he gave up just the one hit, both against the Cardinals today and against the Cubs, so two of the very best in all of baseball, so that's certainly encouraging and hopefully a sign of what's to come down the road for Brandon Finnegan. Like I said, two consecutive starts of six innings and no runs given up. Phil, though, on the other end of that pitching spectrum for this team, Cody Reed really continues to struggle. Another highly touted prospect, but he is still searching for that first career win after falling to 0-6 and I believe eight career starts, the ERA north of 7. And I know that, you know, a lot of times when you see a young guy struggle like this out of the gate, the first thing to do or the first reaction you have is to send him back down to AAA. But Brian Price, though, has taken a different stand on this. He says, you know what, he's not going to benefit, he's not going to gain from going back to AAA. He's got to work things out at this level, at the very best level, the major league level. Some people disagree. What side of the fence are you on here?
This is not a team that's pushing to make the playoffs. The pressure to perform is pretty much the same whether you're in AAA or the major leagues when you're on a team that is not in a playoff hunt. What's different is the caliber of the hitters you're facing. And I agree. I mean, you've got to have success against the best hitters to gain your confidence. Obviously, within the organization, there's a feeling that Cody Reed has the toughness to take some lumps. That's what, you would worry about. Will a guy continuing to hit his head against the wall lose his confidence? Will that hurt his development? Clearly, the Reds, Brian Price, feels this is a hard-headed guy. And he's right that the only way a pitcher is going to gain the confidence that his stuff will work against big league hitters is to see the stuff work against big league hitters. So, he's gambling in the next three or four starts, which is all he would have been able to make in AAA, this being August, that in those three or four starts, something will click. One particular matchup, he'll have a couple of left-handed hitters in a row come up, and he will bury him, and that will sort of flip the switch, and all of a sudden, you know, he will feel like a guy that should be pitching in the big league. So I totally understand the thinking, and the key to whether it works or not is really the mental toughness that Reed has. The easier thing is to send him out, but if he's a mentally tough guy, this will be good for him.
Yeah, it'll be very good. And, I mean, it's one thing for a guy who's, say, a 10-year veteran to go through a struggle like this when they have a track record of success. But for a guy Reed's age and with little experience and with no track record of success, it makes that mental anguish that much more to know that you have no confidence to draw from, at least from a major league success standpoint. So it's an uphill battle right now for Cody Reed. But like you said, he is proving himself to be kind of a mentally tough kid. He's going to work himself through this, and hopefully that success will come sooner rather than later. And, Phil, one aspect of the team I want to really touch on that hasn't gotten a lot of press, at least not mainstream, maybe in Cincy, though, but the work of the bullpen. I mean, in talking to Mark Sheldon, our MLB.com reporter for the Reds, earlier this season, you know, we spent every week talking about how bad the bullpen was, quite frankly. But now, I mean, I'm not saying that they're the 2015 Royals, but it's been much improved. And I think the two guys at the front of that have been Michael Lorenzen and Raisel Iglesias. And Iglesias, a guy that really intrigues me. He was the opening day starter for this team. He gets hurt, and then they place him in the bullpen upon returning. Well, all he's done is put together 20 consecutive scoreless innings as a reliever. So do the Reds feel that he's found a permanent home in that bullpen, or do they feel that, you know what, he's clearly got his stuff back, his mojo, his confidence, and we don't want to waste him, quote-unquote, that's not the right word, but we don't want to waste him in the bullpen. We want to get him back in that rotation. What do you think the line of thinking is here regarding Iglesias?
I think he's going to be in the bullpen for a while. I mean, it doesn't mean he can't move into the rotation. I look at guys like Kenny Rogers at the start of his career, Pedro Martinez at the start of his career. You know, you can be a guy with really good stuff, and to spend 2 or 3 years in the major leagues kind of learning your craft as a reliever does not limit your long-term potential, and it, you know, you actually could be conserving yourself. And I think the Reds are smart to value the seventh and eighth innings. Not that they didn't value them in the past, but you know, they've had a really hard time, as you and Mark talked about, finding guys that could get a lead to the closer. When that was Aroldis Chapman, they just couldn't seem to do it, and post Chapman, the same thing. That is a quick way to improve your team. I know the last time the Reds were at Wrigley Field to play the Cubs, people in the Cubs clubhouse were talking about how the Reds are becoming a tough team to play, that lineup, especially the top six hitters in the lineup, are no fun for the pitchers. And then you can get down to some uncomfortable at-bats at the end of the game. Lorenzen, you know, has a perfect reliever arm. You know, he's that perfect power arm that everybody's looking for to find to build a bullpen around. So he and Iglesias could be, you know, they could really be pieces that help the Reds get turned around. And it doesn't mean that they're not going to have, in Iglesias' case, probably especially, he's not going to have a long, successful career as a starter, but this could be a nice way to ease into it.
Yeah, and that's a great comparison you made with the career trajectory of Pedro Martinez, the way that he started out with the L.A. Dodgers. We saw what he became, a Hall of Famer, of course. And in my humble opinion, there will never be another Pedro. But we have heard in the past, the recent past, some comparisons between Iglesias and Pedro, the makeup, the arm, the electricity. Do you kind of see that too? Are there some flashes of Pedro Martinez when you watch Iglesias sometimes?
Well, I think Pedro gets brought up a lot when somebody has an electric arm and it's not packaged in Nolan Ryan's body. Marcus Stroman comes to mind. I think it's a natural, easy comparison to make. And a flattering one to the guys it gets made to. I think we should let Iglesias play out. And this is a guy who had success in Cuba before he came to the major leagues. So he has his own identity. I don't think he has to be Pedro.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's a very tough comparison to put any, you know, young pitcher under an all-time great like Pedro Martinez. But so far, so good for Raisel Iglesias. Like I said, over 20 innings of scoreless ball out of that Reds bullpen. He has helped completely turn that thing around in what was once a very beleaguered Reds bullpen. Phil Rogers, we appreciate the time filling in this week on this Thursday, and we will certainly talk again soon. In the meantime, Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Cincinnati Reds.